Chapter 4. The Rat Patrol jeeps concluded their mission after leading the convoy deep inside of Kuchi Base Camp. All 126 Cherries stood in the trucks, trying in vain to rid themselves of the clinging red dust. Bill laughed when John removed his sunglasses. "What's so funny? You have white rings around your eyes. And what, that's supposed to be funny? Yeah, with all that red shit on your face, you look like a fucking raccoon. At least you can see my eyes. Your whole head looks like it was dipped in shit." "Oh, go ahead and have your fun," Bill grumbled. He brushed himself feverishly in an attempt to get all the dust removed from his clothes. "Give me a hand wiping my back and I'll brush you off." "Okay, just don't play with my ass when I turn around," John replied. "You're all ass, and I won't be able to avoid it." "What, are you a comedian now?" As they finished brushing each other's back, loud voices on the side of the trucks were barking commands to the group. "All right, Cherries, un-ass my trucks right now. Come on, move it. I mean now. Let's go, everyone." "I want four ranks starting right here," bellowed an impatient Puerto Rican sergeant. He stood 40 feet away and drew a long line across the ground with a large stick. "Let's go, get on the line. I don't have all day," he barked. The Cherries leapt from the trucks and moved quickly to form four ranks, unsure if punishment was forthcoming for not being on the line fast enough. "What the fuck, are we in basic training again?" John mumbled to Bill. "I hope not. We're supposed to be done with all that. This is Vietnam, isn't it?" The sergeant paraded back and forth in front of the formation. He wore a black baseball cap with the word CADRE stenciled on the front in large white letters. It was impossible to see the look in his eyes, as mirrored aviator sunglasses covered them. His beer belly looked unnatural for a man with a 34-inch waist, and it bounced with every step he took.
"Listen up, Cherries,"
he shouted in an attempt to get the ranks to settle down.
"You are here for a mandatory week-long course of in-country training. During this time, we will review your past training and teach you all about your enemy. Our first class will begin in 15 minutes. When I give the word, grab your gear and store it in the hooches behind me. Then return to the exact spot you are standing in right now. You'll all have plenty of time later to unpack and get squared away. You have 10 minutes starting now. Move out!"
The ranks collapsed as men rushed to find their duffel bags in the large pile. Once in hand, they raced to the various hooches. Bill and John could not find two adjacent cots in either of the first two hooches, but were successful in the third one. They threw the gear on top and moved back outside.
"What do you suppose this gonna be like?" Bill asked.
"Most likely a lot of classroom training, just like we did in basic."
"Hell, I thought there's a war going on here. Why are we going to sit around in classrooms?" Bill complained.
"You heard the guy. He said that we're going to learn all about the enemy."
"Well, what more do we have to learn? Little guy out there has a gun and wants to kill me. I have to kill him first. It's that simple. We don't need to learn anything more."
The Puerto Rican sergeant led the formation to a large shaded area not far from the hooches. This was the first classroom of the day.
"Have a seat on the ground, gentlemen. If you have any smokes, feel free to light up."
He stood in front of the group next to a large 6-foot-wide green chalkboard mounted between two trees. Sergeant Ramon, printed in large white chalky letters across the top, let everybody know who he was.
"Don't be afraid to sit on the ground,"
he stated after observing the reluctance of some to do so.
"You'll be mighty lucky if this is the dirtiest you get in this country. You ground pounders,
infantry,
will be living on the ground, so get used to it now while there's no pressure on you."
He waited for the entire group to take a seat before continuing.
"This area is where you will come for most of the classes during this course. My name is Sergeant Ramon."
He enunciated both syllables and then used the stick to point out his name on the board.
"I will be one of your instructors during this next week. Today, we will review military maneuvers, different attack and defensive formations, and military alphabet, coding, map reading, and the proper use of the PRC-25 field radio. Are there any questions before we begin?"
No hands went up.
"Good. Let's get started."
Later that day, John and Bill unpacked their belongings in the single-story screen building. "Those classes we just finished were not all that bad," John admitted.
"Now, I beg to differ with you. It's boring as hell to go over all that shit again. We had enough of it shoved down our throats in the last 6 months."
"It may be boring, but look at it this way. It's one less day that we'll have to spend in the field."
Bill thought about that statement for a second, and then replied,
"Yeah, I guess you're right."
John looked up at his watch, surprised. Damn, it's already 10:30. We better get some sleep. I have a feeling it's going to be another long day tomorrow. Both flopped down on the hard, olive-colored canvas cots and quickly fell asleep. The following morning, everyone drew out an M16 rifle from the armory before heading out for the first class of the day. "Good morning, gentlemen," the instructor began after everyone was seated in the outdoor classroom. "We will spend the morning taking these weapons apart, cleaning them, and then putting them back together again." Moans and objections echoed from the crowd. "Oh, fuck. We did all this shit hundreds of times already. What a fucking waste." The instructor, having heard enough, got everyone's undivided attention when he struck the chalkboard with a stick. It sounded like the sharp crack of a rifle. "Knock off the bullshit," he ordered. "This part of the class is so important that it may very well save your lives." He pushed both hands into his pants pockets and walked among the group. "It's true that you've done this 100 times already, but how many of you can do it blindfolded? Do you know that most attacks and firefights occur in the dead of night? It is pitch black, and you cannot see your hand in front of your face. Now, just suppose your weapon fails during one of these firefights, and the VC are rushing over the wire to kill you. Are you able to take your M16 apart and fix it in the dark so you can protect yourself?"
He hesitated for a few seconds and then continued.
"Before this class is over today, each of you will learn to do just that. The circumstances will be different. It won't be dark and enemy soldiers will not be trying to kill you, but you will successfully demonstrate this ability while blindfolded."
Again, protest and moaning sounded from the group.
"This is bullshit. Fuck this shit. I'm a cook. I probably won't handle a rifle for the whole time I'm here."
The infantry guys took the advice to heart and began to disassemble and assemble their weapons. Each time they were more proficient and confident. There was no need for blindfolds. They were able to demonstrate this task with their eyes closed. After lunch, the group returned to the classroom with weapons in hand. "I sure feel more confident being here with a rifle now," Bill said.
"I know what you mean. We've been in country almost a week, and this is the first time I've actually held one in my hands."
"Isn't that odd, too, with everything we heard about Vietnam during our training in the States?"
"You're right, Bill. I was expecting to get shot at or at least mortared while we walked off that plane."
"I was thinking the same thing. Now, if you think about the replacement center and now this place, aside from the convoys, I haven't seen anyone carrying a weapon or heard shots fired since our arrival."
"I don't know what to think. Maybe all that shit in training was just a bunch of brainwashing."
"Maybe, maybe not," Bill responded. "This is, supposedly, a secure rear area. And maybe they already killed all the enemy soldiers around here. I heard some of the guys talking earlier about fire bases out in the boonies. That's where the real shit hits the fan."
"I wish we could just stay here," John said sincerely.
"Me too, old buddy."
The class spent the afternoon on the firing range, where each soldier could test fire his weapon. They hit many of the targets. Bits and pieces of cardboard sailed through the air and fell onto the already littered ground. Puffs of dirt rose into the air around each target as the bullets burrowed deep into the dry, hard earth. After each person had fired 30 rounds, they gathered and began walking back to the outdoor training classroom. Sergeant Ramon was waiting there for everyone to complete the short walk back from the firing range.
"Gentlemen, everybody enjoy target practice?"
"Yeah, it's great."
"Well, it's about time."
"Good, I'm glad you enjoyed yourselves. We're all done for the day, except for the cleaning of these weapons."
The men groaned one more time.
"Nobody leaves for chow until each piece of equipment is spotless and returned to the armory. I will look them over later this evening, and God help the poor slob who did not do a good enough job. After chow, you are on your own until the morning formation. Have a good evening."
Sergeant Ramon left the Cherries and headed toward the mess hall.
"Well, so much for our sense of security," John spat.
"I know the feeling."
The following morning, the class returned to the firing range, where they found various weapons displayed, both on a table and at different intervals across the range firing positions. 5 additional cadres were also present to help with this class. Sergeant Ramon split the men into 5 groups, so each person would have an opportunity to fire many of them. The arsenal consisted of M79 grenade launchers, 50 caliber and M60 machine guns, 1 sniper rifle with attached scope, smoke grenades, and a 60-millimeter mortar tube and base plate. The cadre put on a mortar demonstration and fired 3 rounds, white phosphorus, a night flare, and high explosive.
for the soldiers seeing them for the first time. One lucky person in each group would also have the opportunity to fire the Law, a two-piece plastic disposable rocket launcher. When fully opened, it measured 30 inches long and looked similar to a shortened World War II bazooka. After lunch, work details picked up spent brass shell casings from the ground, rebuilt the destroyed practice bunker, and cleaned the arsenal of fired weapons. It was late in the evening when the last detail returned to the barracks. On the fourth morning, John and Bill walked to the range with the rest of the class.
"What do you think they have in store for us today?"
Bill asked.
"I don't have a clue, but it does seem odd that we're going without weapons."
"It sure does," Bill agreed. Upon their arrival, the Cherries took a seat on the ground. This was now an automatic reflex, and nobody hesitated or complained. A large black staff sergeant, who could pass for a professional football player, was their instructor for the day. He was holding a short rifle in one hand. Wood covered most of the barrel and stock. A half-circle, 12-inch-long black magazine protruded from the housing, an inch in front of the trigger guard. Perhaps it was possible for the shooter to hold on to the magazine and fire it like the Tommy guns of old. Under the barrel, a pointed, 2-foot-long, finger-thick piece of silver metal lies horizontally, secured to the weapon by a hinge.
"What kind of gun you suppose that is?"
Bill asked and motioned toward the instructor with his head.
"I've never seen anything like it before. Maybe it's a VC gun or something new we have to learn how to fire."
Bill simply shrugged.
"Makes sense to me."
The 6'8", 260-pound instructor removed his black cap with his free hand, using the sleeve to wipe the sweat from his forehead. Moisture on his freshly shaven head glistened in the sunlight. After returning his cap, he smiled brightly to the class, exposing a gold cap on one front tooth.
"Gentlemen," he began, "I'm Staff Sergeant Jones, and now let me introduce you to the Russian-made AK-47 assault rifle. This little beauty is the primary weapon of your enemy."
He held the rifle high in the air for all to see.
"At times, it is more accurate, deadly, and dependable than your M16. This banana clip holds 30 rounds instead of the 20 in our magazines,"
he said, ejecting the magazine and holding it high in the air.
"You should also note that the enemy's bullets are larger."
The instructor set the rifle on the table and then pushed out one of the rounds from the magazine. After placing the magazine on the table next to the weapon, he reached into a pants pocket and withdrew an M16 bullet. With a bullet in each hand, he lifted them both high into the air so the audience could see the difference.
"This 7.62mm round is identical to those that we use in our M60 machine guns. It is larger and has a lot of power, definitely doing some damage when hit. As you can see, the M16 rounds are smaller, but their design allows them to tumble when hitting something. So a hit in the stomach may exit from the hip or upper back, tearing up everything in between."
He placed the two rounds in a pocket and picked up the rifle from the table.
"And this is the bayonet,"
he continued, grabbing the silver steel appendage and unfolding it until it clicked and locked in a fully extended position.
"It is permanently fixed to the rifle and folds down when not in use. If Charlie sticks you with this, you'll be in a world of hurt."
He replaced the weapon on the table, then looked up to scan the many faces in the class. Most showed concern.
"During the last 6 months of training, each of you has become accustomed to the sound of your own rifles. Today, I will fire this rifle and some other enemy weapons to demonstrate the distinct sound each one makes. It is very important that you recognize these different sounds because not all rifles are the same. The war in Vietnam is a guerrilla war where you will hear the enemy more than you will see him. When ambushed in the dense jungle with a weapon fired next to you, the sound of the weapon will determine immediately if it is a friend or foe. Your very lives and the lives of your fellow soldiers depend on you knowing the difference. I'm quite certain all of you were always on the sending end of a bullet since joining the military. How many of you know that every weapon makes a different sound when the bullet is flying toward you or overhead?"
The class shifted about nervously, nobody daring to raise their hand in acknowledgement to his question.
"Is this fucker going to shoot at us?"
Bill whispered.
"Would it surprise you?"
The sergeant continued.
"Before this day is over, I will guarantee that each of you will be able to distinguish between the pop of this AK-47 and the sharp crack of your own M16, so let's get started."
He reinserted the magazine and chambered a round in the Russian weapon.
"Listen closely."
He fired 10 single shots downrange, spaced about 3 seconds apart, and then switched to automatic,
emptying the magazine in two short bursts.
"Gentlemen, what you just heard were the sounds of your enemy's weapon when firing away from you. Now you get an opportunity to hear the same weapon when that firing is directed toward you."
He moved the class uprange, halfway to the targets, and then returned to the firing line. The Cherries were sitting on the ground, facing the targets. Some panicked after this sergeant fired a short burst over their heads. They jumped to their feet and bolted toward the firing line, like fullbacks running all out to score a touchdown. Yet others crawled toward a nearby dried stream bed and lay prone in the depression. Upon seeing this, the staff sergeant roared with laughter.
"Damn! You Cherries never cease to amaze me! Now listen up!"
He was not trying to embarrass anyone, but by this point could barely contain his laughter.
"Nobody's gonna get shot on this range. I'm fine 20 feet over your goddamn heads, which is an extremely safe distance."
He turned and addressed the half-dozen soldiers standing on the firing line with him.
"Get your asses back out on that range with the others!"
The men hung back, stalling. One of them even turned around and kicked at the dirt, hoping to create a dust cloud large enough so the sergeant could not see him. Finally, after some coaxing and encouragement, they all walked back to mid-range and lay in the dried creek bed with everyone else.
"Okay, let's try this again,"
the sergeant yelled when they were all safely in place. The group remained in that prone position for almost an hour as Staff Sergeant Jones fired the different enemy weapons. Aside from the AK-47, his arsenal also included an RPD machine gun, SKS rifle, and a Chicom pistol. When he was confident that his class had learned the lesson for the day, he called out,
"The demonstration is over. Everyone come back to the firing line."
The Cherries stood up, brushing themselves off before walking toward the awaiting staff sergeant. Once they were clear of the firing range, he gathered them together.
"Okay, man, are there any questions regarding the sounds you've heard today?"
Not seeing any hands, he continued.
"That's good. I must have been real convincing. Before we break for the day, I have one final demonstration for you."
Staff Sergeant Jones walked over to his Jeep and emerged with yet another strange weapon.
"Gentlemen, this is a rocket-propelled grenade and launcher called an RPG for short. It is very deadly and feared most by the mechanized and aviation units, although the enemy uses them in routine firefights too. It is just like our law and can penetrate 7 inches of armor before exploding. This weapon is responsible for shooting down helicopters and destroying or disabling APCs and tanks as well. Unlike the law, it has no backblast, so the shooter does not have to worry about a clear field of fire behind him. Now keep your eye on the practice bunker to your front."
The RPG resembled a 4-foot green pipe with a long orange pineapple-shaped missile sticking out from the front. There were a couple of extra rounds lying on the ground, each resembling a pineapple attached to a stick. Jones leveled the weapon, aimed through the sight, and fired. The men could clearly see the speeding missile and its trailing exhaust. They watched it all the way to its target. When the round hit, the impact created a cloud of dust a microsecond before the entire structure exploded outward. The results were much more devastating than that of the law demonstration the day before. Debris scattered further away. Rebuilding would take twice as long.
"Holy shit!" Bill exclaimed. "Look at what that thing did! Wow, that is some awesome weapon,"
John added.
"How you stop something like that?"
"By shooting the fuckers before he fires the damn thing."
"Well, if you don't see him first,
then when you see it bearing down on you, either jump the fuck out of the way or take a second to kiss your ass goodbye."
The next few classes were the most intriguing of the entire week, dealing with enemy booby traps and their deployment. Sergeant Jones and Ramon were the primary instructors.
"Most of the time, booby traps are very cleverly concealed and remain undetected until it's too late,"
the black sergeant began.
"In these classes, we will make you aware of the many different types of booby traps and how to avoid them. You must also take precautions against supplying Charlie in the field."
This statement baffled the Cherries. "Who in her right mind would do that?" Bill questioned.
"Shh, listen, he'll probably tell us,"
a person sitting behind Bill whispered, poking him playfully in the center of his back.
"Use extreme caution when using trails and roads, entering village huts and tunnels, uncovering caches, moving around on rice paddy dikes, and on frequently used landing zones. These are all coveted locations for booby traps. Most of their booby traps are intended to maim and not kill. Charlie uses them for two reasons. The first is to slow down a unit, And the second is the probability of shooting down the unarmed helicopter when it arrives to evacuate the wounded.
Staff Sergeant Jones finished the introduction and stepped to the side. A few minutes passed, and then Sergeant Ramon walked before the class.
Many booby traps used by the enemy are armed with pressure release devices. A person is safe when standing on one, but the second he steps off, the sudden drop in pressure will explode the charge. You could lose a foot, a leg, or even die from shock. One of the most feared of all booby traps is the Bouncing Betty.
The infantry soldiers perked up at this revelation, leaning forward, anxious to hear more.
Buried, it has a tripping device sticking out of the ground. This mine has two charges. One will propel a balloon-shaped explosive charge upward, and the second will explode at waist level, throwing shrapnel into the stomach and groin areas. If you survive, chances are excellent that you'll be left without your manhood to start a family.
Many of the men reached down and checked their genitals, as if they were doing so for the very last time. Each looked at his neighbor with pursed lips and wide eyes, shaking their heads incredulously.
Some of Charlie's booby traps include American issue items. At times, the infantry soldier is hot, tired, and gets lazy. The long patrols in this climate will force many to discard items to lighten the unbearable loads. They may throw away belts of ammunition, grenades, claymore mines, and M79 rounds into the jungle. However, some of these items can also be left behind quite by accident. After a break on the side of the trail, you may get up and unknowingly have an item fall off or out of your rucksack. Charlie makes a point to search those trails thoroughly.
He loves to find grenades, as they are the easiest to convert into a booby trap. All he has to do is tie them to a tree, attach one end of the tripwire to the pin, and run it across the trail. The thin fishing line is hard to see, but it is strong enough to pull the pin from the grenade when somebody walks into it. Favorite scrounging areas for Charlie are those locations where Americans get resupplied and those of a former night defensive position. GIs always have an abundance of supplies and seldom use all they get. Unwanted sea rations, detonation cord, and personal effects lay discarded throughout these areas. Some are buried, but most are not.
Sergeant Ramon broke in to continue.
A claymore mine is an anti-personnel plastic mine, 8 inches wide by 5 inches high and 1 inch thick. It contains hundreds of 1/4-inch steel balls embedded into the cover, and when detonated, they blow outward, covering an arc of 130 degrees. The killing zone is within 30 feet. Every soldier in the field carries at least two of them, which are set up during the night around defensive perimeters. Sometimes the soldiers are rushing and forget about them, leaving them behind. Heat tabs used for heating, water, and food are another simple luxury a soldier can't live without in the field. Most of us hate sea rations as it is, and eating them cold is out of the question. After running out of heat tabs, some soldiers have cracked open the claymore mines and removed the plastic C4 explosive to heat their food. If it is not compressed, it burns like gasoline. Then, no longer needing the casing with the embedded steel projectiles, the grunts have thrown them away into the jungle. Now, what do you suppose Charlie does with them when finding such a prize?
The class responded in unison.
Booby traps.
Correct. The United States Armed Forces has fired billions of artillery and mortar rounds since their arrival in this country. And occasionally, some are duds and do not explode. Charlie is very resourceful in finding them and converting them into booby traps as well. He will hang them in trees or lay them on the side of a trail, arming them in one of two ways, by a tripwire or command detonation device. This kind of booby trap can waste an entire platoon.
Jones cut back in.
We are creatures of habit, and many soldiers are injured because of it. At least one of every five soldiers would either pick up or kick a can if he sees it lying on the trail. Charlie knows about this strange American habit. He will booby trap anything that may appeal to the curiosity of young soldiers or to the fortune hunters looking for souvenirs. The punji pit is another type of booby trap. They vary in size from 1 foot to 6 foot deep. Pointed stakes as round as pencils line the bottom of the pit. Their tips, dipped in shit, can be fatal if they break the skin. These pits look very natural in the middle of a path once twigs and leaves cover them. However, many of them were dug during the 1950s when the French fought here, and over time, they have long since rotted. If a soldier were to step into one of these older pits, the stakes would crumble, and the most he'd end up with is a sprained ankle or a knee. These pits are rare, and again, primarily used earlier in the war. Do not accept bottles of whiskey or soda from the villagers, as many of them are VC sympathizers.
They grind up glass and put it into the sealed bottles. The shards are so fine, it's difficult to see them with the naked eye. If you drink from these bottles, the slivers of glass will tear up your insides. For those of you heading out to the bush, let me leave you with a final thought. Burn or bury what you do not use. Never leave it behind for your enemy to find, because they will find some way to use it against you. This concludes your in-country training. If you'd learned anything in the course that will save your life, then we have succeeded in our goals. At this time, we are asking that you return to your hooches, retrieve your gear, and fall out into the assembly area for the last formation. Once everyone is there, you will receive orders and transportation to your new units. Good luck, everyone.
What outfit are you going to, Bill? John asked.
Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 27th Infantry.
All right, so am I.
Oh, talk about luck. This is great.
We've been together this long. It'd be a shame to break us up now.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
They picked up their gear and moved toward one of the trucks.
Where are you guys headed?
The driver called down from his cab.
1st Battalion, 27th Infantry,
they replied.
Hey, that's the Wolfhounds. You guys really lucked out.
Why's that?
John asked.
Shit you hadn't heard? The Wolfhounds are the most ass-kicking outfit in this division. They're so bad the VC post wanted posters with huge rewards throughout the area of the operations.
Really?
No shit, Bill and John responded together. Excitement lit their faces. The driver announced,
throw your shit in the back and jump on board. I'll run you guys up the road to their area.
Thanks.
The two men climbed on board and joined 20 other Cherries. When they arrived in the new area, the first sergeant had been expecting them. He was waiting outside the orderly room, a gray building with a large blue board mounted to the front. On top, it read, Company A Body Count, in tall white letters. Just below the heading, two 18-inch white painted bones formed an oblong X. A human skull hung over the center of the crossed bones. If the board were black, it would have looked like a pirate flag. In any case, it was apparent that the purpose of the board represented death. Beneath the skull and crossbones, the left column listed each of the platoons, and to their right, a column with four rows of numbers. 1st Platoon had the highest number of kills with 37. 4th Platoon only had 12. After the first sergeant was certain that all the Cherries had enough time to scrutinize the tote board, he introduced himself.
Gentlemen, my name is 1st Sergeant Michaels, but you can call me Top. I would like to welcome you all to Alpha Company, 1st Battalion Wolfhounds. As you can see by the number of combined kills, we are kicking ass out in the bush.
How often do the numbers go back to zero?
Someone asked.
We go back to zero each quarter, so what you see listed today is from July 1st until now. If there are no more questions...
He hesitated for a moment, and not seeing any hands raised, he continued.
When I call out your name, raise your hand so I can see you, and I'll assign you to one of the four platoons.
Top called four names before calling Bill, and then John immediately after him. Bill was going to the 3rd platoon, and John to the 1st.
Way to go, buddy,
John consoled.
Well, it's bound to happen sooner or later.
Let's talk to Top after the formation and see if he'll put us together in the same platoon.
It's worth a try, and we don't have anything to lose if he turns us down.
Bill agreed.
Tomorrow, Top continued after completing the list of names, you eight men will fly out to our forward fire support base, Keene. You will draw out weapons and all the other supplies needed just before leaving in the morning. When the meeting is over, you can head over to the platoon barracks and find an empty cot for the night. Signs on each building will let you know if you are in the right one or not. I want everybody back here in formation again at 0800 hours. Until that time, you are all on your own and welcome to visit the service club or PX down the road. You're dismissed.
Bill and John struck out with the first sergeant, who quickly shot down their request to be together. Disappointed, they departed in different directions, but agreed to meet again in front of the orderly room in 15 minutes.
Are you cool with checking out the sights in this camp?
John asked.
I've been dying to see this place. Between those classes, eating and sleeping, we haven't been able to do shit in the last week,
Bill drawled.
Well, we better get started. We only have a half a day to sightsee.
Koo Chi was the main base camp for all units of the 25th Division, and it would take the rest of the day for them to tour the enormous base. These rear echelon troops really haven't made here. It's like living in a big city, John stated matter-of-factly while observing the surroundings. They found the PX similar to a large department store in the States. A person could buy anything from newspapers to television sets. It even boasted a catalog department. The service club included a library, writing rooms, a TV room, a small cafeteria, and individual recording rooms under one roof. The recording rooms were a little larger than telephone booths, but inside, a person could listen to his favorite record or cassette tape and relax in private. Many of the soldiers in Vietnam recorded letters to their families on cassette tapes and then mailed them home. Upon receiving a cassette, he could return and play it back on the recorders. Every night, the Red Cross female volunteers, Donut Dollies, conducted bingo games in the cafeteria. Since it was free, there was usually a large turnout. The prizes were small, normally a wallet or a transistor radio, but the games were not important. Soldiers only went there to see these American female volunteers. Outside of the hospitals, this was the next best place to see round-eyed women. Just down the street from the service club, they found an Olympic-sized swimming pool with both 1- and 3-meter diving boards. Bathing suits were available for anyone wishing to take a dip. It, too, was crowded during this late afternoon. Further down the road, they discovered an authentic Chinese restaurant. Rumors had it that the food was delicious and a welcome change from the Army Chow or Service Club hamburgers. During the tour, someone mentioned that the forward infantry companies came out of the field periodically and would spend 3 days in Cu Chi to rest and recuperate, R&R. He said that resting in the security of the base camp was a great way of relieving the built-up stress after grueling weeks or even months in the bush. John lay wide awake on his cot. Thoughts of leaving for the fire base in the morning rambled through his head. He had no idea what it would be like, and the uncertainty continued to feed his anxiety. He flashed back to an earlier conversation with Bill just prior to calling it a night. Bill was nervous, too, and expressed how sad it was that they would not have each other for close support any longer. However, Top assured them that their paths would cross on numerous occasions, not only in the field or in the firebase, but also during R&R in Cu Chi. He said that they should not take the separation as though they would never see each other again. John was a pessimist and worried that every time something was going to change, it would not be in his best interest. However, he did realize that, in reality, nothing bad had happened to date. On the contrary, every change had turned out to be a good experience. Perhaps the odds would continue in his favor, and tomorrow would be uneventful. He felt somewhat relieved and eventually dozed off, alone in the 1st Platoon barracks. The next morning, Top instructed the 8 infantry Cherries to empty out the contents of their duffel bags onto the ground, telling them to toss all military clothing forward, one pile for fatigue tops and the other for pants. It was unnecessary for them to take fatigues out to the firebase. Clean uniforms were usually available during each resupply. Of those remaining personal items, the first sergeant cautioned the men to take only what they were willing to carry on their backs. After choosing the most treasured of keepsakes, the remaining items went back into their duffel bags for storage in the company supply building, accessible to the men whenever in Cu Chi. The company clerk, PFC Jimmy Ray, led the line of men to the supply building. First, they dropped off their duffel bags, then received weapons and a limited amount of gear. Each man signed for an M16 rifle, a bandolier of 200 rounds of ammunition, 10 empty magazines, a steel helmet with liner, 2 canteens, a canteen cup with web gear, which resembled a wide canvas belt, and a set of suspenders. Top gave them an hour to get everything squared away. Each of them loaded their 10 magazines with ammo, placing 5 in 2 pouches on the web gear belt and the rest back into the green cotton bandolier, which hung from the shoulder. After packing and inspecting their weapons, the Cherries moved to the portable water tank, Water Buffalo, to fill canteens. The water was still cool from the lower night temperatures, but would soon be warm and difficult to drink. Top wished them well and sent them on their way. The company clerk escorted the group to the landing pad near Battalion HQ, where 3 Huey helicopters waited. Each helicopter had the insignia of the 25th Infantry painted on its nose. 2 were completely full of clothing, mail, ammunition, and cases of sea rations, beer, and ice. The clerk instructed the 8 Cherries to load up on the remaining chopper. John and Bill teamed up and headed toward their transportation.
These are some badass-looking guys, John observed, looking over the crews. The two door gunners wore flak jackets and sat on each side of the helicopter. Both were busy checking their M60 machine guns mounted on a swivel to their front, the barrels pointing down and outward from each side. Opening a can and extracting a belt of ammunition, the gunners placed one end into the loading mechanism and then closed the cover to lock the belt of ammo in place. The belt of 300 rounds would allow the gunner to fire controlled bursts for up to 3 minutes if fired upon by the enemy. The entire crew was dressed in olive drab flight suits with dozens of zippered pockets and olive green flight helmets with black sun shields. The helmets had internal speakers, a small microphone on a flexible metallic arm attached to the side of the helmet for communication. A cord extended from the helmet to a jack in the wall. When plugged in, the crew could communicate with each other through the internal intercom, as well as broadcast over the radio on many available frequencies. Both pilots wore shoulder holsters with 9mm pistols. "They look cool as hell," John commented, taking a seat on the floor just behind the pilot. His legs stuck out of the helicopter and dangled toward the landing skids. Bill took a position in the doorway between John and the door gunner.
"Yep, they sure do,"
Bill agreed, looking for a way to hold on tight. When the grunts were all aboard, both door gunners leaned out to check the area around the aircraft, announcing over the intercom that the rotor was clear. A loud whining noise alerted everyone that the turbine engines were starting. The overhead rotor blades began turning slowly, gaining momentum with each rotation. The helicopter started to vibrate and shake wildly as if trying to break away from invisible bonds securing it to the ground. It lifted from the ground a few feet, slowly at first, throwing dirt and stones in every direction. When at a height of 6 feet, the chopper turned 180 degrees, dipping its nose slightly, and then raced forward. The three helicopter formations climbed into the sky, heading west and away from Kuchi. As the airships gained speed and altitude, the wind rushed in through the open side bay doors, catching the unsuspecting cherries in a mini tornado or vortex inside.
"Hey, Pollock, hold on to me!"
Bill hollered in a panic above the noise of the engines and wind.
"Shit, you hold on to me! My ass is sliding toward the door, and I don't know if I'm going to be sucked out or blown out!"
John yelled, hoping his voice carried over the loud noise.
"Come on, Pollock, I'm not kidding!"
Bill screamed.
"I can't stop myself from sliding out the door!" "Use your right hand to hold on to the door gunner seat, and then loop your other arm in mine. I'll use my left arm to push away on the wall next to the door."
That seemed to work, stopping their sliding sensation. However, their faces paled and their eyes were wide with terror.
"Keep doing this! It seems to be working!"
John shouted.
"Neither of us is leaving this ship till it lands!"
Once the flight left the populated areas around Kuchi, the sights below were mostly thick jungle and small villages with surrounding rice paddies. Dirt trails snaked everywhere, extending in many different directions. Suddenly, a large clearing came into view. Bunkers and barbed wire surrounded an area the size of a football field. Artillery guns and mortar pits were visible near the center of the compound. There was movement below, and many individuals were walking about shirtless and gathering near the main gate. The sliding sensation finally subsided as the helicopter slowed and dropped altitude. Bill and John puffed their cheeks out and breathed slowly from pursed lips in an effort to catch their breath. The flight took 20 minutes. The copter was now preparing to land in an area by the front gate, just outside of Fire Support Base Keene.